Bible class today, and didn't get but about a third of the way through what I wanted to, and so I've decided to finish up what I would like to say tonight, for one thing, because I think it's beneficial. You can determine whether you think it is or not, but Nathan Ingram has been teaching a class on fear and how not to let fear scare you to death. And I've really enjoyed the class. We all always enjoy Nathan's classes. When we first came here, I thought, I don't know if I've ever known anybody that was as eclectic in their class. They just start off, and you don't know where he's talking about this, and he talks about that, and you don't know where in the world he's going. And then all of a sudden, he's tied this thing up in a way that's very applicable to you. And he always does that. So you get to the point that you almost know you can't tie it together until he ties it together for you. And so he asked me, they're gone this weekend, and he asked me to teach his class. And so I got the opportunity to do some thinking and studying about fear. And topical sermons are not particularly my favorite. I enjoy teaching classes on certain topics. But this one on fear really took my fancy, I guess. There are lots of things that we're afraid of. It would be real interesting to go around and if you know any Greek word, you can say the Greek word and you put phobia on the back of it and you can come up with it. You know, hydrophobia, the fear of water, and arachnophobia is the fear of spiders, and you can just keep on with any Greek word you know and put phobia behind it, and it's a word. And if it's not one, then you can make it one. You can coin it. One of the fears I always have is that somebody in a public prayer, rather than saying, "Lord, bless those of this congregation who are sick," will say, "Lord, bless those who are sick of this congregation." And that always kind of gets to me when somebody says that, and I've heard that a few times, you know. That, but there are lots of fears that we have. Began this morning with an introduction talking about Jesus asked what on the surface appear to be some really ridiculous questions at times. And John chapter 5, verse 6, you don't have to go there. I'll just rehearse it quickly, and I won't put you back through that, those of you, because many of you were in the class where Jesus asked the man there at the pool who had been crippled for 38 years. He came up, and if you put the various gospel accounts together, then he walked around and he observed the many people that were there. And he walked over to one particular guy and he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" Corey had a lesson on that not too long ago. I think we talked about that one time in a class also. So you just think about asking a guy who's been crippled for 38 years if he wants to get well, and you think, well, that's kind of like one of those questions where you walk up to somebody in order to start a conversation. You say, "Well, how are you today?" You know, and then you're just dismayed if they start really telling you how they are today. You know, you're not really asking because, you know how that goes. And so sometimes we just throw something out to get a conversation started. And you wonder, did Jesus ever do this? And my answer to that is, I don't think Jesus ever asked a superfluous question. I don't think he ever asked a question that was not intended to cause us to really introspect. And I think this question really, really did. I think the guy didn't take it that way. Maybe later in his life he might have, and as because Jesus made him well, and all of a sudden all of the expectations changed in his life. There were obviously some really good things that happened now that he could walk that he couldn't, but there's also a downside to that, because now there's a new level of expectation for him, and I wonder if sometime later in his life there weren't times at least when he thought, you know, I was better off in some ways whenever I was crippled, because now I have to get out and work. People have expectation for me, and before, you know, I didn't have to physically work, and very likely he didn't learn a trade or he wouldn't have been there, you know, like he was. And so when Jesus asked him the question, John 5, 6, "Do you want to get well?" He answered it superficially, if you can call what he did an answer. He just started telling why it wasn't possible or what all the difficulties were of why he was in the situation that he was. You know, he said, somebody brings me here every day, and when the water is stirred, somebody else always beats me to it. And so when Jesus asked him, do you want to get well, that was his response. And you can decide if you think that's an answer or not. It is an answer of sorts, but it's not an answer, yes, I want to get well, or no, I don't want to get well. He just started telling why he was in the situation he was. And I think there's an application there, because I think it's very possible for some of us that we have some sin in our life, that when we think of the idea of being free from sin, we're just elated at the thought. But then whenever it comes to the point that Jesus says, okay, your sins have been forgiven and now I want you to live this way, then we've got some pet sins that we might want to be dragging along with us, and we might start closeting some things in our life that in fact we may find out, in all honesty, that we really didn't want to get rid of that sin. We were pretty attached to it. We liked it a lot. And it kind of, maybe even in some cases, it helped define who we were. And now that we're a new person, it's a completely different life, and we're uncomfortable with it. And so Jesus asked a question that on the surface, if you'll allow me to say, it was something of a ridiculous question. It appeared to be, and in fact it wasn't. And then use that to set the stage from Matthew chapter 8, verse 26, where he asked those in the boat, you of little faith, why are you so afraid? And that, again, I would categorize as one of those questions that seemed to be pretty ridiculous on the surface, because you go back and get the setting. He got into the boat when his disciples followed him, and without warning, a furious storm came up on the lake so that the waves swept over the boat. And this account is also in Mark 4 and Luke 8, and you can go back and read the three accounts, put them together, and get some details about it. One of either Mark or Luke 1 says that the boat was being swamped. Water was filling the boat up. And they were a distance away from the shore. And by the way, Galilee is about 13 miles long and about 7.5 miles wide. So if you can get that in your mind, that body of water there, then it's a fair size body of water. And situated at the end of the valley between the Lebanon and anti-Lebanon mountains, then there are currents that come down that valley, as there are in all long mountain ranges that are parallel. Then it's not unusual that difficult weather will form in those valleys, and certainly there's almost always wind that sweeps down through those valleys. And the Sea of Galilee is situated. We're not going to sing that song right at this moment. But the Sea of Galilee is situated right at the end of that valley. And so when it says without warning, you know, it wasn't like you could see a cloud bank coming and get prepared for it. It just was there on them all of a sudden. And the waves were breaking over the boat, and the boat was being swamped. But it says Jesus was... And Matthew says, the NIV says, sleeping. The Greek gives it a little more intense word. He was peacefully sleeping in the middle of all this. Disciples woke him, saying, Lord, save us, we're going to drown. And he replied, you of little faith, why are you so afraid? So he got up and rebuked the winds and the waves, and it was completely calm. And the question that I want us to consider is, why are you so afraid? And... you know, did they answer his question, first of all? Well, we don't have any recording that they responded to his question, because it was one of those questions that, as far as they were concerned, didn't require an answer, right? I mean, just, duh, look around you. You know, the waves are breaking over. Look how much water is in the boat. Look how far we are from the land. Look how high the waves are. You know, why would I have to answer a question like this? And it's one of those questions that doesn't require an answer, except it does require an answer. Not from just a human standpoint, but it's kind of like that question that he asked that cripple guy. why are you so afraid? And from a human standpoint, the answer is really obvious. But from God's standpoint, it's not so obvious. And there are some reasons why it's not. And we introduced a little bit about fear. And I asked the question, was Jesus afraid? When he woke up and saw those waves and saw the water in the boat, you think he got real excited and, you know, got all of a sudden his heart started thumping real hard? I don't think it did. I think he was just as calm as if he had been awakened and the sea was glassy calm. I don't think there was any difference. Why? Because he knew that somebody was in control. Now that's what I want to talk to you about. Because I really believe this is the key to the matter of fear. We don't fear things that we can control. We fear things that are out of our control. Now, there's a few keys that we need to really remind each other of. The truth of the matter is we never are in control. We just fool ourselves into thinking we are. And when you realize that, and you realize is there anybody in control? Well, who's in control if somebody's in control? And is that a good thing or a bad thing that somebody else is in control? Fear is a distressing emotion aroused by impending danger, evil, pain, etc. Whether the threat is real or imagined, the feeling or condition of being afraid. And so it is an emotion. Question. Are phobias unfounded fears? Well, it depends on whose they are. If they're mine, they're not unfounded. If they're yours, they're unfounded. You know, I have to smile sometimes when I hear some people talk about the things that they're afraid of, because I'm not afraid of those things. And you'll get a kick out of the things that I'm afraid of. And I'll crack the door a little bit and tell you that against all reasonableness, I won't get on a Ferris wheel. I don't like them. I'm afraid of them. And I can stand on the ground and look at somebody way up there in that thing, and these kids are rocking this thing back and forth, and I had to turn around and walk away. I can't stand watching it. And the reason is because it makes me feel so totally out of control. If something were to happen when I was up there, there's not one thing I can do about it except fall. And I don't like that thought. Now, I don't know why, but if there are other rides at carnivals that some people are afraid of, you remember, this is the old hat stuff now, but what was it, the Texas Giant? It probably doesn't even operate anymore. I don't know if it does or not. It's Six Flags, but you go up, what was it, 10 stories or somebody, so many stories up high, and then they ratchet you out and you free fall and this thing. I wasn't afraid of that. Now, I don't know why. You know, it's something about the way that I look at it, and it doesn't scare me. But that going around on that Ferris wheel and being up at the top of that thing, that scares me. And my heart won't quit thumping. And I don't get on them anymore, so I'm assuming that it would still do that, because I intend to die, not getting back on another one. But so phobias are not unfounded, depending on whose they are. What is it that causes fear? Well, situations or circumstances or events that we feel like threaten us in some way. Threaten to take control away from us. Threaten our security. Threaten to harm us, or physically or otherwise. It may harm our pride. You know, why do we fear getting up in front of people and speaking? We're afraid we're going to make a fool out of ourselves. We're afraid we're going to get up there and forget. We're afraid that people are going to laugh at us. We're afraid of whatever. It's something to do with our pride, isn't it? And that's a very real fear, and it's a very, very common fear. But fear comes because these situations or circumstances or events which either do or we feel like they do rob us of control of the situation. And if you think you can control it, then you're not afraid of it. And so, with that in mind, what is necessary to keep us from being afraid? Well, let me tell you what I think it is. I think it is to know that someone is in control. And I have to say, you have to know that not just someone, not just any someone is in control, but a special someone is in control. You have to know something about that someone who's in control. I used to lead, and on lots of occasions have led, groups of Christians on short-term overseas mission trips. And I was the one who organized it and led the group. And, you know, I was kind of hard-nosed about some things. Like, you know, I took everybody's passport up, and I was responsible for carrying their passports, and particularly if it was a group of young folks, because somebody invariably lost their passport, and the whole group was messed up. So, you know, I made them all give me their passports. And I was kind of hard-nosed about being the leader of the group. And I like being, to be real honest with you, I like being the one that was in control of the group. But I also made some trips where I wasn't the one that organized it or in control. And I found out that I was really happy on some of those trips. And some of those trips I wasn't very happy about. And so as I think about why I was content to be just one of the Indians instead of the chief in that situation, it occurs to me that I had to know some things and believe some things about the person who was in control in order to be content. Or otherwise, I wanted to be the one to hold my own passport and make my own plans and, you know, do my own thing. But if I knew certain things, if there were certain things I was confident of about the person who was the leader, I'd make a really good follower. And I've learned that about myself. But I need to know some things about him. I need to know three things specifically. Number one, what is his agenda? In other words, does he want what I want? Are we on the same page about what this is all about, what this trip or whatever it is that we're on? Are we on the same page? I think that the Jewish people in Russia and in Poland and in Germany in World War II found out that there was someone that was in control, but it was not a comfort to them that Hitler was in control, was it? Because he had an agenda that ran counter to their welfare. And so just having somebody and knowing that somebody's in control is not good enough. In order to cast your lot with someone, you have to buy into their agenda. You have to be traveling the same road. You have to be going to the same destination. And as I think about Jesus' agenda in life, I have to learn to like his agenda. I like it generally. But there are some places that he goes and he wants me to follow that I'm not real comfortable. And fear starts seeping out around the edges in me. And when he tells me that he wants me to go and talk to my neighbor about the gospel, then I start getting all antsy. You know, we've got some folks here that go to prisons and talk to prisoners. If you've never been to a prison, and particularly to a penitentiary, and you've never heard that steel door clang behind you, you don't know what fear is the first time that you do that. I mean, your heart, you know, your mind is telling you this is all right. You know, they're not going to keep you here. But when that door slams shut, it does a little something to you. And there are things associated with following Jesus that tend to foster some fear in us. And sometimes we let those fears keep us from doing it. And we spend lots of time justifying ourselves, kind of like that guy that Jesus came to and says, you know, do you want to be well? Then we start telling him why we can't be well and why it's not possible for me to do that. And sometimes I think we may treat God that same way when we know that he wants us to do a certain thing and we start telling him why. And since he's not right here to slap us, then, you know, we think that he accepts our excuses and our reasonings, when in fact he may not. What is his agenda? Well, I'll pick a verse that might surprise you a little bit. Titus chapter 2, verse 14. It says, speaking of Jesus, it said, who gave himself for us for two reasons, to redeem us from all wickedness and to purify for himself a people of his very own, eager to do what's good. And I wonder sometimes if I really do want to be redeemed from all wickedness. And if I really, really do want to do good, as he defines good, that I'm eager to do that. And in order to follow somebody without fear, and in order to obey their marching orders and do what they tell you to do, then you have to agree with their agenda, or you won't cast your lot with them. And so the first thing that's necessary to enable me to not be afraid is I have to know who I'm following, and I have to agree with his agenda. And I think there might be a catch there for some of us, at least to some degree. And then secondly, how much power or control does he or she actually have? If maybe I get down the road with them, I might find out that they can hit some things along the way that are out of their control. And now not only am I in trouble, but he's in trouble. We're both in trouble now because things are out of control, and I thought he could control them, and I find out, as a matter of fact, he can't control them. And when he comes to the things that I'm really afraid of, can he control those things? I had a friend, a black friend, when I was growing up, and his name was Armadillo. And I may have told you this story before, but we chopped cotton together when I was a kid, and he did it by choice. I did it not by choice because it was my dad's cotton, and I didn't have a choice about it. But anyway, we were hoeing the cotton, and a little snake ran across my row, and I reached down to chop his head off and wound him around a hoe and swung it around and called his name and said, hey, Armadillo, look. And he looked around, and there was a snake hanging in front of his face. Well, I didn't know that anybody could be that afraid of anything. I mean, instantly he screamed, and he went down on the ground, and he went into some kind of spasms and started foaming at the mouth and was thrashing around. And, you know, it just scared me nearly as bad as it scared him, because I thought he was going to die. And so I run over there and bend over him to try to help him. And all of a sudden, his eyes clear up and he looks at me, and he's never looked at me quite that way before. And I knew that this was not going to be good, whatever was about to happen. And he jumped up and grabbed his hoe, and he had decided he was going to do what he could to me with that hoe. And so I started running, and he was a lot taller than I was and a lot thinner than I was, and he could normally outrun me, but you can run as fast as you need to. And I also found out that you don't want to run down the cotton row because you need all the resistance. He needed all the resistance that he could get to slow him down, so I went sideways and ran across it, you know, and I'm popping this cotton running across, and I can hear this hole coming right behind my head. And so I don't have time to turn around and see how close he might be. But at some point I realized it wasn't as close as he once was. And so I looked over my shoulder, and he's down on his knees. And he's just crying like a little baby. And so I slowly and cautiously circle back a little bit. Don't get real close, but close enough that we can communicate, you know. And I'm apologizing, you know, the whole time. And he tells me, he said, don't never do that again. And I said, but I promise, I won't ever. do that again. We can be really, in my mind, that was an unfounded fear, but it didn't change the fact that he was terrified of it. You remember the story in the Bible about Paul and the poisonous viper there in Acts 28, whenever he was on his voyage to Rome and he gathered some firewood after the shipwreck and they were building a fire and there was a poisonous snake, must have been one of those three-step snakes they talk about in Africa that, you know, you take three steps and you're dead, because whenever he was gathering the wood, there was this viper that came out and attached itself to his hands, and the natives saw it happen, and they knew, they said, he must have really done something really, really bad. Here he is, he's escaped this shipwreck, and now he's about to die from this. And they watched him to watch him die, and he didn't die. It didn't even affect him. He just shook it off in the fire. And one of the questions that comes to my mind is, could God have kept that snake from being on that stick of wood? And if he was there, could God have kept that snake from biting him? Sure he could have. But God let the snake be there, or he put it there, whichever the case may be. And he let it bite him, or he caused it to bite him, whichever you prefer. And it occurs to me that because the snake was there, and because it bit him, doesn't mean, number one, that God couldn't have stopped it. And it doesn't mean that he didn't care, does it? It means that God had another agenda. I don't always know what God's doing. It doesn't always make sense to me, and he didn't ask my permission, and there are some things that happen to me that I don't particularly care for. How about you? There are some things that God allows / causes to happen in my life that really do upset me. Sometimes it's really, really painful. And some people will decide at that point that there must not be a God, or this wouldn't have happened. Or they will decide that God either couldn't do anything about it, or he didn't want to do anything about it. He doesn't care. Jesus claims, all power, authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. How much does that leave out? Not a bit. None. He doesn't ask you to accept that without proof. He wants to give you some evidence so that you will believe that with all of your heart, that he's totally in control of this world. Sometime when we study Matthew, we'll go through and we'll look at chapters 8 and 9, because that's why the Holy Spirit had Matthew put those two chapters in there. He just has a succession of things that Jesus did, miraculous things that he did, to prove that he can control and does exercise control over everything in this world that causes us to be afraid. Everything. There's nothing left out. Matthew chapter 8, verse 1 through 17, Jesus demonstrated his power over disease, more than one kind. He just picked the worst kind known to man at that time, and that's where he started off, with leprosy. In 8:23 through 27, he demonstrated his power over nature. We just read this one about he told the sea to calm down, and it immediately calmed down. In Matthew chapter 8, verse 28 through 34, he demonstrates his power over the supernatural, where he tells the demons, go. And they go. They don't have a choice. In chapter 9, verse 1 through 7, he demonstrates his power over sin. When the four guys let their friend down through the ceiling, and he says, son, your sins are forgiven, and everybody gets all upset. And he said, which is it easier to say? Your sins are forgiven, or rise, take up your mat, and walk. But then, in order that you may know that the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins, arise, take up your mat, and walk. And when he got up, took his mat up, folded up, put it under his arm, walked out the door, he just proved that he had power to forgive sins. That's what he said that was for. And then in chapter 9, verse 18 through 26, he demonstrated his power over death by raising someone from the dead. Now, if you analyze those things, disease, nature, supernatural, sin, and death, you'll realize that there's not anything in this world that causes you to fear that doesn't fall into those categories. And what did he just do with those series, by putting those series of miracles together? He wants you to know that he has power over everything. And so when you get out there and you're following him and you encounter something that causes you to be afraid, know this for sure: he's in control. And then the third thing that we have to know is, does he care about me? And really what we want to know is, how much does he care about me? And you think about how important that is. There's one detail, one of the details that Matthew doesn't tell us about in this storm incident that Mark adds. You remember what the disciples asked Jesus? Matthew didn't record it, but Mark does. Do you happen to remember what the disciples asked Jesus when they went and shook him awake? They woke him up in the bow of the boat. They asked him a question that Matthew didn't say. They asked this: don't you care that we drowned? We really do have to know that. It's important that we know that he cares and that how much he cares. You see, because fear erodes our confidence in God. All of a sudden, if you had asked them just prior to this event, you know, when they were all climbing in the boat together, if you had asked them, does Jesus care about you, they would have told you how much he cared about them. But all of a sudden, fear caused them to not be quite as sure about how much he cared about them. And it happens to you and me too. We can sit here and talk about this, and we can give each other all the reassurance in the world of how much God loves us, and then when something really difficult comes into our life, all of a sudden, it begins to kind of creep in a little bit. How much does he really care? Fear spawns doubt. Fear kills faith. Fear makes us forgetful of what God has done for us up to this point in our life. All of a sudden, it's as if everything is erased that he's done up to this point, and we forget that he's brought us safely to this point. And he has time after time after time overcome difficulties in our life. And we can look back and say, wow, you know, I didn't know what in the world he was doing at this point. But I can look back now and see that even though he didn't follow my plan, he followed his plan, and his plan was a lot better than mine. Why can't we assume he's doing the same thing again? He's done it over and over in our life, hasn't he? Why is it that we just automatically forget everything that he's done when we come to a point that we fear? Fear makes us focus on the negative, doesn't it? You can't even think anything positive. All of a sudden, you start thinking of all the what-ifs, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and you can't think of anything except negative things. Here's my question, one of the questions. Do you know that Jesus cares? Now, there's an... is that one of those stupid questions? You know that he cares. That's, you know the answer, right? You automatically have the answer, but do you really, really, really know that he cares? And what would demonstrate to you how much he cares? Well, you know the answer to that as much as I do. John 3:16. He so loved the world. He so cares. God does that he gave his only begotten Son. And his only begotten Son cares so much that he went to the cross voluntarily when he didn't have to. Does he care? Back to the disciples in the boat to wind this up. Question: did they have reason to be afraid? I'm not going to answer that for you. You answer that for yourself. Did they have reason to be afraid? This is one of those, when Jesus said, why are you so afraid? This is one of those questions that's a duh question, but it's not really. It's one that causes us to look deep and introspect ourselves. Give ourselves a good gut check right here. Do we really believe all that we're saying? Do we really believe that he's in control? Do we really buy into his agenda? Do we really believe and are convinced that he loves me more than he loves his own life? Do you really think that Jesus expected them to not be afraid? I'm not going to answer that question for you either. Do you really think that he expected them not to be afraid? O ye of little faith, why are you so afraid? What are you afraid of? Why? Why? Do you not think somebody's in control? And if we would know that, and if we would live that before we got to the end of our rope, we would know what true peace means. To believe that he's in control and he has a purpose for my life and he's working all things together for good in my life, and that when things happen that seem to me to be obviously out of my control, do I suddenly react with terror, or can I be calm and believe with all of my heart that he's in control and he knows what he's doing? And so the big question, I think, in all this comes down to this. Am I really content with God being the one who controls my life? Or do I have to be the one in control? Do I trust him enough that I can let him be in control of my life and be happy about it every moment of every day while we stand and sing?